receiving an education and so on. They may have battles in terms of enrollment and so on. But to what extent is there a problem? I see that you're now saying new national research suggests that 20% of the school-age children of asylum seekers are not in school. Would this also pertain to people who are who haven't, for example, been granted asylum status, who are refugees, who are just in the country without being documented? You know, to what extent is in numbers now? You know, what is 14% of what? Is it out of 10? Is it out of a million? What are we talking about in terms of the numbers? And are there areas of prevalence? In other words, are there pockets geographically that you could identify where there are such problems? And perhaps then the interventions that need to be made could be more localized as opposed to these kinds of national efforts that you're suggesting. And then, of course, the issue of xenophobic, and I don't even want to call it xenophobia because it kind of almost labels, puts a nice label on something that is just completely atrocious. It's discrimination, it's racism, that's what it is. And for that kind of behavior to be displayed on the part of teachers is for me so appalling that I would want to certainly suggest that if you guys have encountered such instances, I certainly hope that this matter has not been left and that you have taken it further and that you have laid complaints against individuals who have been guilty of this behavior, because teachers are really there. One of the primary objectives of teachers really is to impart the kind of values espoused in our constitution, to be the kind of role models that we can be proud of and certainly can be proud to expose our young minds to. So maybe all of those things. Members? Dr. Kloppers-Lawrence, Mr. Skosana, Mr. Becker, if you want to also add, please feel free. Go ahead, Dr. Kloppers-Lawrence.
You've touched on problems like fee exemption and no fee schools, and then you also mentioned that some of these learners are forced to go to schools in areas where we have quintile 5 schools. And obviously, these principals are forced to enroll these learners, but they're not able to pay. I visited, or actually attended a meeting of Tswane South in January this year, the district, and many of the principals underlined the burden that these learners create on SGBs and the other parents of the school communities. Do you have any solutions to those problems regarding funding?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, under no fee school, I should think this one is police, as my colleague has presented here, that no fee school must cover all the learners at school. In fact, there is no need for any discrimination on this matter. I should think if they find some, in fact, if the very same cases on a certain school, we need to work on this and work together so that we can make sure that we assist those learners. Now my question is, on the refugees, we have got those who came in this country as refugees and they are registered as refugees, which means are legal refugees, and the illegal ones who came here without registering with the department or knowing by anybody. Now, what does the policy say on that in terms of registering those learners at school? Because we do have such people. They just stay in the within the community. They don't have documentation. They don't apply for documentation. They just stay there. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the questions and the comments. I will start with the chairperson's question around the ambiguity. What do we mean when we're talking about the ambiguity of Section 39 of the Immigration Act? That section actually, let me just read from here, says that no institution is allowed to knowingly give instruction or training to an undocumented person. And for us, the sector, COMSA and members, we are saying if it's talking training and instruction, for us that's normally, it's not explaining whether they mean in terms of tertiary education or it means in terms of primary education. And if it means primary education, that for us is a contradiction in terms of the universal right to education for every child, universally. Because that's not only within the South African Constitution, but in terms also of the international conventions around the right to education, it's a universal right for all children of the world, regardless of their immigration status. This is why we're saying that.
Let me ask you this. Are schools actually raising this issue with you? In other words, to say, well, we're prevented by the Immigration Act from not from enabling you to register as part of our school community.
Actually, we haven't come across schools that would really quote the Act and say the Act says this, but it's the actions. They would say because the child doesn't have any documentation, therefore we would not
But that's a separate issue. That's about saying, well, I don't know what this document means, and so therefore it doesn't accord with my idea of what a birth certificate should be. And, you know, it's really a question of training people to say, look, these are the also documents that people can use when they register children at schools.
I mean, at the school level, principals and educators won't be using the Act, but as you go higher within the department, they'd be saying, but the Immigration Act says this. I mean, we've engaged with them, even with the former DG on this one, Duncan Hensel, to say, can you, as a department, issue a directive clarifying the responsibility of schools in terms of admitting undocumented migrants? I mean, it's been quite a long time.
And was that forthcoming?
No, because they're always saying the legal department is looking into it, legal services is looking into it. So it's an issue that we're still working on to get that formal
routine. Can you send us copies of that correspondence and so on so that we can then follow it up, okay?
Okay, thanks. The next one was around to question of what extent are refugees migrants successful? But also in terms of those who are having difficulties, what are the numbers? In terms of the numbers, I will not be able to provide that to you now, but I can provide it in terms of my polished presentation. And the data that we used here was quoted from the study that was done by Forced Migration Studies Program at FEDS, where they did a national survey with the refugee at the refugee reception offices, but also with various NGOs that are working with refugees and migrants in the country and the refugees and migrants themselves. So that information is available. We can just forward it to you. And then also in terms of the sample numbers that they used, we can forward that to you. But also I want to highlight in this regard that in some areas, honestly, there's been some positive spin-offs with engagement, whether with individual school principals or engaging with the Department of Education, whether it's at a provincial or district level. For instance, Gauteng, there's really much, I think, vigorous engagement in that regard, and there's a district that's really working well. But that's, I think the reason is because there's a high concentration of migrants and refugees, especially around your Yeovil, Hillbro, Berea, you know, Bertrams, all those areas. So there's still some resistance in some schools, but I think there's far better engagement with the schools and the Department of Education in those areas. There's also some notable positive engagement in Durban and also pockets of the Western Cape. We still have challenges, especially with the border areas and Musina specifically.
Okay. Oh, I think I've partly addressed that. The question of the areas of prevalence of such problems. So that's like Joburg Central, border areas, and Durban. And then around xenophobia, I think this is
just a minute. Let's
okay. Sorry.
Ask in terms of those areas of prevalence, do the problems manifest themselves differently in particular ways? Are there areas where, for instance, you'd have the language problems that you were referring to, and other areas where you have a number of these children, but you know, not the problems of language?
Okay, I think the language problem is not prevalent in all the areas. I think what's the cutting across problem is around accessing the schools. So that's just getting the child into the school. I think that's a major problem that's cutting across all the provinces. The language is just pockets. Yeah, there are some areas where there are challenges, some areas where there aren't.
I think what you must do is you must actually supplement your report and give us exactly the kind of problems that you're experiencing in each area, so that we, and certainly the department is then able to develop some localized interventions around perhaps just doing pro forma copies of the kinds of documents that people are entitled to use to access education and so on, you know?
Thanks, that's noted. One other question that came up was around the issues of xenophobia and whether we've reported those cases and if people have been held accountable. I must say that the challenge in that area, while there have been some cases that have been reported, the challenge has been in terms of following up on those cases where refugees and migrants would feel unsafe, or they would come and report to service providers about an incident that has happened, but for fear of a child getting expelled from the school, they would then be asking service providers not to take up the matter with that specific educator. And that's actually, in a way, doing a disservice to those learners, because if they are experiencing problems at school and they are also at the same time expected to perform at their best, we should be able to address any problems that are affecting their well-being within the education system. So that's one of the challenges, the fear that if they report outside of the network, if I may put it like that, outside of the sector, therefore there will be negative repercussions for the children at school. But we are also working with the SAPS through a structure called the UN Protection Working Group, where a system has been created where if we've received, like, for instance, reports of xenophobia or threats of xenophobia, then we report that to the SAPS and they follow up on those. And then within the education system, we are, like I've said, in some provinces we're working very well with some territories within the Department of Education. So we are just developing now some strategies in terms of how to address cases like
well, you might want to also, in that same report where you're going to identify the geographic locations where there are access problems, also give us a sense of where those reports emanate from. We don't need names of individuals, but we do need schools or districts or areas in particular.
The other question was around the burden on Quintile 5, especially where refugee and migrant children go, and whether we have a solution with regard to funding. I mean, one of the things that we are trying to do now is, even before I say that, one of the challenges, you know, when you're speaking to refugee and migrant parents and you ask them why are they not sending their children in, like, Quintiles 1, 2, 3, and 4 schools, that they'll be telling you that it's low education. I want the best for my child. And until we address that perception, because I think that cuts across not only within the refugee communities but also within South African communities, to say the former Model C or Model C schools are still the best, they still offer the best education in the country, we will continue to have that problem. And one of the things that we could suggest as the solution is that, like I've noted before, we don't have a lot of no-fee paying schools within the migrant refugee populated areas. So one of the things that we could do in order to ease that burden for the Quintile 5 schools would be to create those to recategorize some of those schools within those institutions. But while doing that, because one of the things we've noted is that as soon as some of the schools have been recategorized and they go down to a lower grade, parents take their kids out, children out of those schools. So maybe coupled with that would be a massive awareness campaign in terms of what's being offered at that school and how this school intends to maintain that higher standard that it's been at while it was not a low-fee paying school or a lower category, a lower quintile school. But also what we noted in terms of the research that was done by FMSP was that some of the challenges that are experienced by refugee and migrant communities talk to government planning and the allocation of fines. So maybe there might be a need for Department of Education to revise that as soon as they get information, because that is not affected only by refugees and migrants, but also by internal migration of people moving from rural areas to urban areas and the effect that has at the schools in those urban areas. And then there was a question around the legal versus illegal refugees. We don't have such a thing as an illegal refugee. If a person is a refugee, they're a refugee. The question is whether they are documented or not documented. Refugees are allowed in terms of South African law and international law to enter the country without any documentation, but they are also expected to present themselves at the nearest refugee reception office and declare their intention to apply for asylum. And once they apply for asylum, they are then issued with a valid asylum seeker permit. And once their case has been adjudicated on, they are either granted refugee status in the country, which is for now valid for 2 years and renewable, or they are rejected and given an opportunity to make an appeal, of which if it's successful, then they can stay in the country, they get refugee status. If it's not, there's a whole lot of process that can still follow going up to the High Court to try and get the refugee status. And then on the other hand, we have, and also with the challenges at Home Affairs, it's been difficult for some people to get documentation within a reasonable period of time, like within 30 days or 60 days. But I must say that there's been huge improvements within the Department of Home Affairs with regards to the documentation part. And then we have undocumented migrants, people who would not qualify for asylum, but we have come to the country purely for economic reasons, but who are not covered currently by the Immigration Act. That means they are not coming to South Africa to study, they are not highly skilled, so they wouldn't qualify for quota work permits. So they fall here, they don't have relatives in South Africa where they can get a visitor's visa to come to South Africa, or a relative's visa to come and visit a relative in South Africa, or people who come from countries where they are having challenges with regards to issuing travel documents to begin with, and therefore their citizens would be expected to be staying there. So those are the people that I think maybe the member of the committee was trying to talk to say those people who are not documented but who are in the country, what are we saying about those? When it comes to the right to access to education, like I've said, it's the right to education for every child that should be at school, whether documented or undocumented. We don't envisage a situation where, because the parents entered the country illegally or undocumented in the country, that therefore should affect the best interest of the child. And having said that, we are currently engaged with the Department of Home Affairs in various levels in trying to advocate for a permitting system that would cover some of the people that are not currently being covered by the Immigration Act as it stands. And the department is in the process of doing immigration review, looking at their various legislation and seeing what are the current challenges and how can the gaps within the current act then address some of those gaps.
Well, in those instances, on what basis do the principals who are registering those kids into their schools actually do so? Because clearly, unlike the issue with the people who are seeking refugee status or asylum seekers, whose documentation perhaps may be delayed due to the interim period that they have to wait for such documents, these people would not be able to produce any kind or any form of documentation.
And what happens in your experience practically in this regard?
Well, it varies from case to case. You find this, you know, with the embassies here in South Africa, some people are actually able to eventually document themselves. Or if a child is born of undocumented parents but is born in South Africa, that child is eventually, through the assistance by various legal practitioners, is eventually able to get a birth certificate to confirm that it was born in South Africa, even if it can still be categorized as a foreigner. So most of the schools that have accepted children, in some, especially in rural areas, they don't tend to be strict in terms of asking for documentation, because even the South African system itself is having challenges with regards to that. Yeah.
And I think that that really ties in with the whole policy around what happens with undocumented migrants. And clearly the Department of Education won't take a lead in that event. It would have to come from the Department of Home Affairs. But clearly when it comes, so what I'm saying is that in fact what we need to do is to differentiate between refugees, asylum seekers, and people who are undocumented migrants, simply because when it comes to the one, there's a certain protocol that applies, international treaties and so on, which we would have signed as a country, whereas the other issue is a practical reality, but perhaps some of the policy issues and legal issues have not necessarily been sorted out. But on the other hand, when it comes to asylum seekers and refugees and children of refugees, there should be a certain protocol that the department would be able to either issue a directive on or certainly take some kind of mitigating action, particularly in those geographic locations that you would identify in your supplement to your submission.
Well, the way we envisage it, I think, in terms of how we've also presented it, is if it's a child, the child shouldn't suffer because the parents are not documented and therefore the child is not documented. Our principle is that if it's a child and the child needs education and it's basic education, the child must get that education, whether they're a refugee or an undocumented refugee child or an migrant, a child born of migrant, undocumented migrant parents. But I think, like I've said, in terms of our presentation, we'll be able to put, in terms of the supplementation, we'll be able to support that.
Now, I know what your position is. What I'm saying is it's easier for the department to take a lead on the issue of refugees and asylum seekers because clearly the law is certain there. The problem is where the policy of the country is uncertain and, as you point out, conflicting between departments and so on. There you wouldn't expect that the Department of Education would easily be able to issue policies or directives because they're not the lead department on those matters. And then clearly what they would do is they would allow schools to continue in the way that, as you pointed out, school by school or instance by instance. And there the directives would be a little more difficult in extracting from the department. I don't know, Ms. Chubeka, whether your experience is something different.
No, not at all. I think you've put your finger on the nail. What do we say? But anyway, you've identified the problem exactly as it is. So we'll have to use the information that comes to determine exactly, you know, how to handle it.
Members, any further questions, comments? I think that's great. Thank you very much for your submission. Oh, sorry, Ms. Chubeka. Yeah.
It's just a point of information. I think I should use the opportunity to say we the issue of the quintile system and no fee or non-fee paying or paying schools has been something that has come up many, many times. And maybe to reassure the people who are here that that's an area that we're looking at, and we're hoping we can get to a point where we're looking at just fee-paying and no non-fee-paying schools to try and eliminate most of the problems.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your submission, and we look forward to getting your further submission on. And please try and make it as short as possible. because we've got tons of reading to do. Thank you very much. Do we now have Ms. Van Squer here? Okay. We thought you were not going to make it, but I'm glad that you did. You've got 10 minutes to make a presentation. You can take it that we've read your submission already, and we will then thereafter spend some time engaging with you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me this opportunity to present a few of the points raised in our submission to the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education. We'd like to express our gratitude for allowing ESST to share our passion for education in this country. Our submission is 18 pages long, and it makes many points and suggestions and recommendations. I have therefore selected just a few things in order to keep to my time limit of 10 minutes. In our submission, we addressed curriculum content, the issue of values in education, and the issue of equity in education. We made a strong case for a learning-centered classroom rather than a learner-centered classroom. Outcomes-based education has not improved equity, but actually improved the status quo, that children from disadvantaged backgrounds are further disadvantaged and children from advantaged backgrounds are given further advantage. And this is because outcomes-based education, with its learner-centered approach, presupposes a westernized middle-class print-rich culture of learning in order to succeed. These things can all be read in our full submission. This morning I will talk only about the area of curriculum content in terms of values. The aim of the submission and the aim of what we did when we wrote to you was to provoke discussion and debate and problem solving. It poses questions and only begins to tease out possible answers. Fully worked out answers to what is contained here requires the combined expertise of many South Africans. Just to introduce ESST, we are the Educational Support Services Trust. We emerged, we were founded in 1986 at the behest of teachers and community leaders, and in 1989 were formally established. Our aim from the beginning was to support education for the disadvantaged. During the 80s, this meant working with disadvantaged schools across the country, supporting learners' education with a program that went all the way up to grade 10, in which children were given critical and creative thinking skills and educational support across the curriculum. This initial focus has since broadened to include a range of civic education within the field of what may be called development communication. Our roots and primary interest, nevertheless, remains with school-based education. So to talk about values, values in education. In order for one to truly understand the crisis in education in South Africa at the moment, we first have to understand what is meant by education and especially what our nation requires in order for it to attain to the goals that we have set for ourselves. This is therefore an appeal to the education policy as the arrowhead that drives education in this country. Goals and a vision for education are crucial because they speak to the goals that we as a nation possess for ourselves. Where do we want to be in 20, 50, and 100 years from now? Rather than merely where have we come from and how can we overcome our past? Education answers the question as to how we will get to our goal as a nation. If we are not deliberate in our intention, then we will not arrive anywhere, nor will we be able to assess how successful we have been. It is a question of posterity. How can we bring out the best in our children, enabling and equipping them to be everything they were created to be, nurturing and developing their abilities, while doing the same thing for our vision for our future? In a very clear way, education speaks not merely to our need to overcome our past, nor our material aims for our future. For example, the goals of overcoming HIV, of poverty, of finding sustainable solutions to energy, being economically competitive on a global scale, nor to the only to the social-cultural need of moral regeneration in overcoming problems of crime. It speaks to matters of existential concern about what it means to be human and what our purpose is at this point in this country. So basically we advocate a shift in the way we think about ourselves that will lead to a shift in the way we do education. Africa has important values to contribute, a view of life that is holistic and rooted in community. If we agree that it takes a village to raise a child, then our education needs to reflect that. Our society needs to be restored in this dimension. Our communities need to start to share in the adult individual sense of belonging and responsibility towards all children and not merely their own. The children struggling in the rural school with no resources and absent teachers are our children, and it is our concern. Children who are not able to attend school are our children, and this is our concern. It is not merely the concern of the local government or of the grandmother or of the Minister of Education, it is everybody's concern. And it is the failure to think in this way that has brought our country to a precipice with regard to crime and poverty and many things like that. One may ask if the saying, it takes a village to raise a child, can be applied to a complex, modern, dense, and culturally diverse society as our own. And I would say yes, and that there is no other answer apart from yes. Not only are we keepers of one another, we are also keepers of the earth and the natural world. So a mature response to this responsibility is to say, then let us teach our children how to keep one another and how to keep the earth and everything in a way that sustains all life. Children need to be educated from start to finish to be leaders. They will inherit the earth, and so they need to be taught to be stewards of this very significant responsibility. Stewards of the earth and the natural domain, stewards of their own lives, and stewards of society. In everything, leadership and responsibility, mutual accountability one to another for life in all its dimensions needs to be cultivated. Children, learners need to be involved, even at their age, whatever that age may be, basic education, in helping to solve the problems that beset our local sphere, our province, our nation, the continent, and the globe. So what can we say about the years ahead? It is important that with regard to preparing children today for the future, we have to anticipate today what they will require for the times ahead by observing trends and being sufficiently flexible and strategic in our problem solving to adapt to it, which is to say being sufficiently flexible and strategic in our curriculum design. In equipping learners for a future that is distant, if one considers the rapidity with which change is besetting us, it is important to consider that the best way to equip someone to cope with change and to respond to crisis is to equip them with something that is unchanging, their values. It is psychological and moral strength required so that with every problem they face in every arena of life, they have sufficient courage to take it on and sufficient wisdom to find solutions that are determined by values as a bottom line that will promote life in a sustainable way. The problems that we have encountered as a young nation have led to a certain paralysis in the face of its immensity and have also shown solutions that lack a strong conviction of what are values. Solutions that do not exhibit these values and forethought are not feasible and will cause more damage than not. The report of the task team for the review of the implementation of the National Curriculum Statement recommends that life orientation be dropped as a learning area and that only 1 hour a week is given to religious and moral instruction. We strongly disagree with this, and we appreciate that values are included in the instruction of all learning areas, but to reduce to 1 hour a week the dedicated discussion and learning of values and moral concerns is to minimize the subject of singular significance. It is because values and morality have been devalued that apartheid, together with all the other ills of society, was allowed by South Africans and by the global community. We advocate a more strategic approach to curriculum development, that it be reviewed every 5 years in terms of our progress, not only in learner achievement, but also in terms of the challenges besetting our nation and the world. The world and in this country are changing rapidly, and a 5-yearly review is not inappropriate considering how the needs of our society have begun to require new skills and new knowledge of us in the last 5 years. There are complex problems requiring solutions that did not have the urgency 10 years ago that they do today. There are new developments, particularly in the digital world and on the internet, that are revolutionizing the way media and reporting works. It revolutionizes the way we communicate, our culture, and our identity. It changes the way we lead and the influence we possess. Yes.
You're quickly running out of time in your presentation. Don't you want to deal with your recommendations?
Okay.
And that way, because you can take it that we've read your submission.
Okay.
Okay.
We have quite a number of recommendations. The ones that are isolated maybe to discuss today was we recommend that in each province and district a team of local leaders from business, civil society and the academic world form think tank communities within their province and district that agree on how learners in particular grades can interact with the challenges that beset it according to their learning areas and grades. Curriculum development teams and specialists include teachers, including teachers, will then adapt these to the grade and unit standards. Flexibility in the curriculum will allow for these to be added in without compromising on the child's education. More importantly, those people who are working in their daily jobs to solve the said problems need to share with learners the challenges and parameters of the problems so that learners can engage in solving real issues in all the learning fields and having a voice and a role to play in the development of their own local region. The benefits of this are numerous, namely that society is required to partner more concretely with its young in their education.
You're not going to finish on time.
That's basically the only recommendation that we've asked.
Oh, okay.
Within
you
the
only
want to
deal with that.
Yes.
Okay.
In this way, the village raises the child, so I just want to connect those two things. And there are many benefits to add to that. You want to maybe just go into a discussion of the other recommendations as well?
In your presentation, you would sketch out the most important aspects of your presentation and what you want to place before the committee for consideration.
Okay. So that's the main recommendation. We also spoke about civil society playing a greater role in bringing equity, but we didn't give a particular solution to that. We just made a recommendation for it.
Let's do this. Let's start the engagement process, and then out of the engagement process, you can maybe find time to just elaborate on some of your ideas.
Yes.
And maybe you want to begin with this notion of a learning-centered classroom as opposed to a teaching, I assume, centered classroom. When you start saying that, you then elaborate and you say, well, it's what we have currently is not working because what it is, as I understand your submission, is that there is too much of a focus on teaching and not enough on learning.
Correct.
And you want to just put that off so that I don't hear your voice with mine at the same time. Sorry, there's a bit of a speaker right here. And what I want to know is, what does that mean in practical terms? How do you envisage, because this is your recommendation, you're literally saying that class size is unimportant, and the reason why we have such a huge focus on class size is because our fundamental assumption about teaching and learning is incorrect, and that the classroom has to be redefined and so on as a different place. Now, that sounds wonderful, and I'm not an educationist, but if I had to put this to a teacher, I'm sure they'll say, well, what do you mean? How do you achieve such a wonderful place where, you know, size doesn't matter, surely if I'm going to be able to function at this level, perhaps my resources need to be different, my skills need to be different, and we're actually then getting back to the point that you're trying to avoid, which is it might work in the schools that are well-resourced and so on and create enormous amount of inequity in our already inequitous system. So you might want to just chat a little bit about what exactly does that mean? And I take it that, you know, you guys are experts, so you may have even ventured into a pilot of this nature and so on, which is why you make these suggestions.
Yes. we started in this type of work in about 1986 and continued with it until about 2000, and then have done various other projects with schools doing maths and science. The whole shift from that we are recommending from being learner-centered, which is an outcomes-based education value, to learning-centered is that while we value outcomes-based education, and that is our approach, but a learner-centered classroom, like I said before, presupposes that your learners come from a print-rich environment in which they have been exposed to a culture of reading and a culture of learning before they've even come to school. And so that they can take that personal initiative in learning, which outcomes-based does require of the learner. And so in a sense, what learners need to acquire in classrooms is a culture of learning even before they can become learner-centered. So in order to become learner-centered, you have to become learning-centered and have the value of learning and have those cognitive skills put in place by the teacher through the teacher's mediation. The teacher plays a very significant role in this approach. It's no less significant, but the pressure of teaching, in a sense, is taken off the teacher and placed on the learner, because now it's a learning approach, a learning-centered approach. The teacher mediates learning to the learner, and how does that manifest itself? It manifests itself in emphasizing, dedicating teaching that is focused on developing cognitive skills across the curriculum and within the learning field as well. It just places more responsibility on the learner, but it also places responsibility on the resource and on the interaction between the learner and the resource.
Want to explain to me what your proposal is? I know what you're saying is wrong with the system.
Okay.
But I don't know what you're saying is going to fix it.
It's a way of teaching that will fix it. A way of teaching that will enable teachers to engage learners and to infuse learners. You see, it's not the value of teaching does not really rely as much on content knowledge. If you look at the way learners kind of engage with learning, it's not often relies on the teacher's enthusiasm, their own love of learning, and when that love of learning is imparted to the learner together with the content, then it changes the learner's life. So on the one hand, we are advocating for teachers to be trained differently so that they can, first of all, have the value of learning themselves and themselves be learning-centered. So it talks about the training of learners and then training of teachers, and then in the way the teacher teaches, that it's not focused and it's on the teacher themselves, but on the process of discovery within the learner, so that the ratio of teacher to learner time is different. The interaction of the learner with what they're engaging with is different. The learners are taught to ask questions and to engage with those cognitive skills of problem solving with content. Does that make sense?
Maybe you want to speak to us about your ESST program, which I imagine incorporated these things that you're trying to tell me about. And maybe through explaining how you went about achieving your, 40% improvement on candidates' performances, maybe then things become a little more clearer as to what you're talking about that is different from what happens now.
We conducted a program called the English Proficiency Program and the Learning Adventure Program, and we also did the Matriculation Maths and Science Support Program. We also conducted something called the Family Education Program, which was very similar, ran for 5 years, and we had, for 5 years from 1995 to 2000, the Matriculation Support Program was in the 2000s, we conducted it a few times. we developed the material in such a way, it was very much focused on developing material in a way that would develop greater interactivity of learner with the resource. We also trained the teachers, and a lot of the work was focused on group, our approach was group work, in which learners formed groups of about 3 to 4 that were study groups, so to say. They worked through the material themselves, quite literally, and the teacher was there as a mediator and to answer questions, but mainly they worked through it themselves, and we achieved a lot of success in the provinces that we were working, in the schools we were working with, that they achieved much higher percentages overall than those in other schools, and it was literally the use of the resources which were developed with the cognitive skills in mind, and the development of cognitive skills, and it was the fact that they worked in groups and were responsible to each other and to themselves for their own learning. That literally is what achieved what we accomplished. And that's the same applies to the learning adventure.
But I mean, I would have thought that one of the things that OBE has introduced is this concept of group working as well as individual working. What is it that was different?
What is different from OBE than to us?
What was different in your approach? I'm still at a loss to understand what you're putting on the table as an alternative approach.
I kind of thought I explained that, but obviously not clearly enough.
Well, maybe.
But I think it's the thing of learning things. Yeah.
You could just demonstrate what happened in those sessions that does not happen in a classroom of a typical school, for instance. Was it the fact that the kids had to be accountable not to the teacher but to each other? Was it a peer thing, that there was sharing of information more than happens in a... You know, I don't know.
Well, I don't know either. Because I don't have enough knowledge of exactly what happens in a classroom in terms of my personal experience of what happens in a classroom, only in terms of what happened in ours and how we were able to achieve a better marks. It has to do with the fact that there was more peer work, that there was greater responsibility placed on them, that our resources were designed in such a way to engage them on a number of levels, or all the intelligences, so to speak. It really has to do with the fact that it was learning centered, that it took off responsibility from the teachers, and that the teachers were seen as mediators, and that we trained them in that regard. I know that outcomes-based education has taken a lot of those values of cognitive skills, and it has taken all those things on, but somehow there's a gap between the values of OBE and what the teachers have been able to reproduce, because the set of assumptions are different in terms of the culture that students and teachers come to in a classroom in a rural area, in poor underdeveloped areas. The outcomes-based education works very well in a Springfield or Rustenburg or schools like that, Model C schools.
I do understand that point that you're making.
Yes.
Because you're not the first person to make that point. The only difference is that you were invited here today to tell us what your unique solution is to the kind of difficulties that everybody agrees exists. We agree that OBE works better, but in fact any system would work better in a more resourced school, in a school that really draws from a particular class of student and so on, as opposed to a school where the environment has inherently many social challenges, economic challenges, all kinds of manifestations that happen in the community, whether it's violence, crime, etc. All of those things manifest in those schools. And clearly, that has an impact on how the curriculum is then imparted, because there are so many other stresses that pull a learner asunder, as well as the teachers. Now, those things have become quite clear in the hearing. If anything has become clear, it's been those things. Now, the problem is that we understand those things. The question from people like yourself, who actually work on the ground and who say to us in our in your written submissions is that we have got some solutions that work. Now, what we need to understand as policymakers is what makes that work. And if you come here and you say to me you don't know, then that doesn't help me at all. Because we have to sit here and say, well, maybe we can draw from this, this experience of Mr. X, Mr. Y, Mr. Z, and then come up as government and say, well, maybe, you know, these things can work if we start implementing them differently, if we train teachers differently, or if we do X, Y, Z in our classroom. And that's really what I'm trying to elicit from you for a while now.
Okay. The recommendations that we made, we can go into greater detail than that, and I can perhaps put it in a report. I feel like I've said it, but perhaps to go into more detail and to actually really elucidate what those details
are. Let's give you the opportunity to do that, and let me suggest that when you do make that supplementation to your submission, that you be very specific to us about what it is that you found made certain things work in your experience, particularly with these programs that you say you're running in the rural areas. Really, that's why we asked you to come here today. And as far as the other issues are concerned, let's not repeat them because we've got them in the submission. So just be very specific to that issue. I would appreciate it.
Okay.
Mr. Skosana, we've got literally 2 minutes both to pose the question as well as to receive the answer. Thanks.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chairperson, the presentation is very interesting. On page 7, under a question which says, what does the above imply? The first paragraph there, it is said the above suggestions, I'm referring to those points that we're arguing on, Chairperson, the classroom center, learner center, and others that they've talked about here. They say the above suggestions need to be replaced on existing curriculum, but can be introduced alongside the existing curriculum. How? Then they say, instead of dividing the whole day into 40 minutes slots, we suggest a 2-hour period where there is more flexibility than the formal curriculum allows for. I'm really not clear of how can you change this. Within that 2 hours, how can you categorize these minutes in terms of what are you going to do? Because when you talk about the classroom, we are talking about a center where a learner is having a contact with an educator. A learner must get an information from an educator. The educator uses from the learning support materials that we issue to those educators. How can we a little bit get an explanation on this matter?
Very quickly, if you would.
The 2 hours would give a longer period, would enable the learners as groups to engage to engage more deeply in a particular subject and to complete assignments in which they do, in a sense, practically carry things out within more depth and detail. So it just allows them to go deeper into a subject for that period of time. It doesn't mean that they won't. So, you know, I don't know if that says it.
Chairperson, just follow-up question.
Okay.
Chairperson, at school level, in a certain grade, we have got 8 learning areas, as we are talking now. When you talk about 2 hours, and we expect almost 4 learning areas or 5 learning areas to be taught in one day, how many hours are you going to spend? That's the question I'm having in mind.
I think part of the problem is precisely what I tried to address earlier, is that we're not quite understanding practically how this thing is going to work. So I think if you were to address Mr. Skosana's issues in that report, because in that report you're going to give us what specifically you are recommending so that we understand what the... And I think that's part of our problem jointly, is that we're not...
quite coming to grips with what you're proposing, and we're not sure how practical all of that would be. Okay. You can send it when you're able to. All right. Thank you very much. We have run out of time, and let me just take this opportunity to thank each and every one of you. It's been a fascinating morning. Let me also take the opportunity on behalf of the Portfolio Committee to thank all of you for not just coming here today, taking the effort and time to make submissions, but really for your passion that you've shown to us without fail for improving our education system. Your commitments, your drive and so on really inspires us. And we do hope that you take away from today not just this idea that you came to Parliament and you had a presentation in Parliament, but that you actually also, having networked with each other and so on, would have been exposed to new experiences and to new programs and so on, which hopefully will enrich your own work as well. We also would urge you to try and get in those supplementations that we've required from you as soon as possible so that we don't lose focus on some of these issues that you raise. And then let me on behalf of all of the members here, just wish those of you who are traveling far a safe journey. We hope that once we do the report and it's posted on our website, that you will be able to access it and have a look at and see what we then submitted to the department. Thank you very much.